Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jeff Halper of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, who discusses the Palestinian initiative to gain recognition for statehood at the UN this September. Chuck Keeney, an organizer of a June protest action on Blair Mountain, West Virginia, who reflects on how the march to end mountaintop removal coal mining has brought miners and environmentalists together. And Environmental Health Trust founder and president, Dr. Deborah Davis, who shares her views on a recent World Health Organization report linking the use of cell phones with cancer. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Afghanistan is the most dangerous nation on earth to be a woman, according to a survey of gender experts by Trust Law, a project of the London-based Thomson Reuters Foundation. Other countries deemed dangerous for women and girls are the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Pakistan, India, and Somalia. The findings were based on ranking of six factors, including health outcomes, gender violence, cultural and religious factors, and access to economic resources. Despite years of Western aid since the 9/11 attacks, 87% of women in Afghanistan remain illiterate, and over 70% of Afghan women are forced into arranged marriages. Antonella Notari, director of Women Changemakers, which supports women social entrepreneurs, noted that in Afghanistan, women who speak out or take public roles that challenge ingrained gender stereotypes are often intimidated and killed. Pakistan has one of the world's largest number of acid attacks, honor killings, and early marriages, while India, a rising economic power, has a very high rate of female infanticide, which over the last century has cost the lives of 50 million female babies. Across India, farmers have resisted government demands to sell their land to make way for new industry and development projects. India's land seizure law, developed under British colonial rule, the 1894 Land Acquisition Act, usually only pays farmers a fraction of the land's actual value. This law has broken down as farmers and their allies have balked at billions of dollars in new development projects to fuel India's high growth and increased prosperity. According to the Washington Post, the land conflicts have become politically explosive since the prime land for development and industry is located in fertile and densely populated regions near major cities and water supplies. After a five-year fight, South Korea's POSCO Corporation recently acquired land for a $12 billion steel plant. But other big companies, like Tata Motors, have abandoned plans to build new factories after farmers put up strong resistance. In May, the Communist Party of India, which has ruled the Indian state of West Bengal for nearly 35 years, was voted out of office due to anger over rapid industrialization at the expense of farmers. The winner, Mamata Banerjee of the Trinamool Congress Party, championed the farmers' cause as she became the first woman chief minister of West Bengal. In its war on terrorism, the Bush administration created two special prisons in the United States known as Communication Management Units, or CMUs, designed to house terrorist-linked federal inmates. A proposal for these special units was drafted in 2006, but the rules were never officially approved. The prisons were opened in late 2006 and limited an inmate's communication to the outside world to one single-page letter a week, one 15-minute phone call per month, and one hour-long visit per month with family members. Civil rights groups, including the ACLU, objected to the new prison rules as unconstitutional, but these concerns were ignored as the Federal Bureau of Prisons opened the first CMU facility in Terre Haute, Indiana. News of the unit leaked from a letter sent by convicted inmate Rafael Dafir when he was transferred to the CMU unit. In his letter, Dafir said 14 of the 16 inmates in the unit were Muslims, and the rules were so restrictive that inmates could not hug or kiss family members. The federal government opened a second CMU facility in Marion, Illinois in 2008. According to The Nation magazine, a special effort has been made to bring non-Muslims into the facility, specifically targeting animal rights activists linked to the Animal Liberation Front. In March 2010, the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a lawsuit on behalf of CMU inmates, charging the U.S. government with violating the First, Fifth, and Eighth Amendments to the Constitution. The suit alleges the communication management units are discriminatory and punitive in nature. 8 days after the suit was filed, the Obama administration proposed a new rule that expanded the scope of CMU facilities to cover any prisoner, including those held as witnesses. Most inmates incarcerated in the units have been convicted of providing material support to terrorist-linked groups, but not committing acts of violence themselves. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After years of failed U.S.-brokered negotiations for a peace agreement that would establish a Palestinian state alongside Israel, close to 500,000 Israelis now live in settlements on West Bank and East Jerusalem land occupied by Israel since 1967. Palestinians are expected to turn to the United Nations in September for recognition of an independent state on that territory. Recognition would require approval by the five permanent members of the U.N. Security Council. In July, the U.S. convened a failed last-ditch effort to restart peace negotiations in order to thwart U.N. action on the Palestinian initiative. According to a July report in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, rather than risk a veto by the United States in the Security Council, the Palestinian Authority is considering turning directly to the U.N. General Assembly to seek international recognition for a state within the former 1967 borders, but without full member status. Between the Lines, Hazel Kahn spoke with Jeff Halper, co-founder and director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, about the role of the U.S. in peace negotiations, the effort by Palestinians to seek recognition at the U.N., and the worldwide movement for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions against Israel to force an end to the occupation of Palestinian territory. Halper believes U.S. policy toward Palestinian aspirations is crucial to Washington's relations with the rest of the world.
I think the United States is becoming very isolated in the world, and especially around the issue of Israel and Palestine. The Israeli occupation of 44 years, that tremendously inflames not only the Arab and Muslim worlds, but way beyond that, it inflames Europe. It's become the equivalent of the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. Latin America's up in arms about it. Africa is, it's really the conflict that I think has gripped the world community, maybe not the United States, but the rest of the world. And in a sense, the Israeli occupation is seen as an American Israeli occupation. It's clear that Israel couldn't maintain its control over 4 million Palestinians for a week without the political, military, and financial support of the United States. I don't think Americans are aware of the impact this conflict has on their country, including the fact that the United States is seen as being an enemy of human rights in the world because of its stance to support Israel with its flagrant violations of international law and human rights. And the United States is seen as really giving only one thing to the world, and that's military weaponry to dictatorial regimes. This issue is really isolating the U.S. We've been witnessing a so-called American-brokered negotiations between the Israelis and Palestinians. The United States was pretending to be an honest broker. For 20 years, Israel's continued to build settlements. There are now 500,000 Israeli settlers. There were about 150,000 when the peace process, so-called, began 20 years ago. The negotiations have simply broken down completely. And yet the United States keeps saying negotiations are the only way out. And yet the United States supports Israel completely in terms of building settlements and doing everything that neutralize negotiations. If negotiations are over, there's only one remaining course for the Palestinians. And that is to go to the United Nations in September when the United Nations reconvenes, and to ask for full membership as the state of Palestine within the 1967 borders, which is the two-state solution, and ask for full membership in the United Nations. A state on 22% of historic Palestine. The Palestinians aren't asking anything that threatens Israel, takes any Israeli territory. In fact, Israel remains on 78% of the country. Now, the problem is that an application for membership of the UN has to go through the Security Council. And the United States has already announced that it's going to veto a Palestinian state. Why it should veto a Palestinian state is simply not clear. And I think everyone should ask a member of Congress why. Because it's actually Congress that's Israel's strongest and staunchest ally. Congress will not allow the Obama administration, even if it wanted to allow a genuine Palestinian state to emerge. If the Palestinians cannot get a two-state solution through the Security Council, even though in the General Assembly they have the votes probably for recognition, the General Assembly can't overrule the Security Council. What's going to happen, in my view, is something very serious. I think the Palestinian Authority is going to resign or collapse. Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, is simply going to say, what's my function? If there's no political process, there's no negotiations, and the United States will not allow a Palestinian state to emerge, then what am I? I'm simply a collaborator. Israel's policeman in the occupied territories. I think Abu Mazen is weak, but he's not a collaborator. If he resigns, Israel is going to have to reoccupy the West Bank, including all the Palestinian cities. And it's going to have to reoccupy Gaza. You remember the terrible invasion of Gaza a couple years ago, because it can't allow Hamas to step into the vacuum. The very threat of an Israeli reoccupation would so inflame the world that it would force the international community to intervene. And I think Americans are going to find themselves completely adrift in the world. So I think there's a lot riding on this, not only for the Palestinians, of course, but for the United States as well.
So you mentioned in some of the things you've written recently that the Palestinians' real support is coming from international civil society rather than from any particular national alliances. Is there something we as part of the civil society could be doing, should be doing?
The depressing thing is that the governments are not our friends. They don't represent us. They're not honest with us. They don't deal with us, the people. And the only way we can sort of make our will felt is to resist, is to gum up the system. The governments were living very well with apartheid until the civil society began an international campaign of sanctions that finally so embarrassed the governments, including the Reagan government, that they had to somehow adopt the sanctions themselves. In other words, governments will not do the right thing, period, unless they're pushed by the people. So I'm saying, you know, there should be a call to mobilize. We should get 100, 200,000 people on the streets of New York City at the UN headquarters towards the end of September to give tremendous civil society support to the Palestinian application for membership.
That was Jeff Halper, co-founder and director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Tony Ernst assisted in the production of this segment. Find links to more information on the Palestinian Initiative to gain recognition for statehood on our website at btlonline.org. In early June, over 500 people, both locals and outside supporters, recreated the 1921 Miners' March on Blair Mountain, West Virginia. The march, 90 years ago, demanded union rights and pitted thousands of armed miners against coal company security guards, county sheriffs, and ultimately the U.S. Army. The goal of this year's march was to protect Blair Mountain, a national historic site, from mountaintop removal coal extraction, to end all mountaintop removal mining in Appalachia, and to promote local jobs and sustainable communities. The struggle to end mountaintop removal coal mining has attracted prominent supporters including Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and musicians Ashley Judd, Emmylou Harris, and others. Many union members joined the week-long march on Blair Mountain. However, the United Mine Workers Union withdrew its early endorsement of the march because, while it favors protection of Blair Mountain, it does not oppose mountaintop removal coal extraction that provides local jobs. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus was on the march for three of the 5 days and midway through the trek interviewed Chuck Keeney, one of the protest action's organizers. He teaches Appalachian history at a local college and is the great-grandson of Frank Keeney, a leader of the United Mine Workers Union that fought on Blair Mountain in 1921. Keeney talks about the lack of knowledge among many West Virginians about their own history and how this year's March on Blair Mountain has brought miners and environmentalists together.
I learned nothing about Blair Mountain or the West Virginia Mine Wars in school. I learned it like much of the real history of Appalachia that you learn. It's a place without a formal history. It's a place where you learn it at family reunions. You learn it at church potluck dinners. You learn it, you know, at Christmas time. You learn it from songs. You learn it from poetry. You don't learn it in school, because what you get in school is largely dictated by big industry.
So how have things gone so far in terms of what you kind of expected, what you hoped?
You know what? Things have gone better than I expected. We've hit our obstacles. A lot of them have been small little obstacles, but there's been no violence towards the marchers. This was something that I was incredibly concerned about. I don't know if you've heard the story of the march that they tried to do in 1999, in which people were assaulted. In fact, Ken Heckler, the former Secretary of State, was beaten up, and he was 84 at the time. He was beaten to a bloody pulp by a bunch of guys hired by the coal companies. So none of that has happened yet. And so we're very happy about that. Also very happy about the media coverage, the fact that we're able to. I went on the right-wing radio show, and I got to talk to them for 30 minutes and had them saying that all of my goals were reasonable by the end of the discussion. The idea that I was able to do that was just pretty mind-blowing to me. Now, of course, they've done a number of things, like the campsites. The coal companies have used intimidation to shut down the campsites of places where we would have camped. But it tells me that they're afraid of us. It tells us that they fear the impact that we may have.
Massey, which has now been bought by Alpha mm-hmm. Natural Resources, and another company, Arch Coal, both have options to blast on Blair Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And has there been any change? I mean, you have to basically discourage them from doing that.
Yeah, well, we have to get Blair Mountain put back on the National Register of Historic Places, which would protect it. And there are other ways in which we can protect the site. The government can do that. I'm not holding my breath that the state government is going to do that, because the state government is very much on the side of the coal companies. But the federal government can do this. The federal government can declare it a National Historic Site and can protect it. So that's one of the reasons we're trying to do this, to get the attention of the nation so that the public can email the National Register of Historic Places, try to get our president to perhaps intervene at some point and save this national treasure. This is a history that very few people even know. You know, and when we tell them about it, people are like, wow, what an amazing, unique story. And, you know, this is where people laid the groundwork for an American middle class, for weekends, for 40-hour work weeks. And if you think labor organizations aren't important now, look at Wisconsin, look at Michigan, look at all of the things that's happening. These issues are incredibly important, and Blair Mountain is a place where people can rally to that and, you know, see that labor is something that's vitally important to the economic prosperity of the United States.
People on the march have some different points of view. I mean, some people really mm-hmm. think we got to stop coal mining,
mm-hmm.
totally. I mean, as soon as possible, not necessarily, you know, what happened right away. But then there's other people who say, you know, what we need is more underground coal mining because it's more jobs and we need the energy. And
mm-hmm.
so you think people can coexist with different points of view and still have their goals?
Well, you know what? We have coexisted. The example that is most pertinent to me happened a couple of weeks before the march, and I was at Matewan. Matewan is the heart, the belly of the beast of coal country in West Virginia. And I was giving a speech at a union local. Had about 40 coal miners and their families, and then we had about 40 or so environmentalists there. And they were all eating hot dogs together, joking together. We had a talk, you know, and we had a big open discussion. And after the talk, people were coming up to me and saying, this is the first time this has ever happened. The environmentalists and coal miners and union people were sitting under the same roof, talking things out. And that's what Blair Mountain is. It's, you know, not everybody's going to agree 100%, but Blair Mountain is a place where people that have these progressive views, environmentalists, labor unions, historic preservationists, can all kind of come together. And if these groups don't find a way to come together, then they are going to separately be crushed. They have to find a way to work through their differences and come together. And Blair Mountain, I think, is a place in which that can happen.
That was Chuck Keeney, an organizer of June's protest march on Blair Mountain, West Virginia. For more information on the campaign to end mountaintop removal coal mining, visit our website at btlonline.org. After years of speculation about the health hazards of mobile phone use, a panel of scientists at the World Health Organization reported on May 31st that they've concluded using cell phones may increase the risk of developing certain types of brain tumors. A working group of 31 scientists from 14 countries meeting at the WHO's International Agency for Research on Cancer announced that their review of all the available scientific evidence suggested cell phone use should be classified as possibly carcinogenic. While some scientists had previously warned about the dangers of cell phone use, the WHO study marks the first time a major health organization has made a connection between mobile phones and cancer. While the study does not definitively show that cell phone use increases the risk of cancer, the health implications are enormous, considering that an estimated 5 billion people, nearly three-quarters of the world's population, now use mobile phones. As the WHO study has increased public concern about cell phone safety, the wireless phone industry has attempted to debunk the group's warning by funding research of its own, which some critics have labeled as blatant propaganda. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Devra Davis, founder and president of the group Environmental Health Trust, who discusses the importance of the World Health Organization's report on the health hazards associated with cell phones and what can be done to reduce the risk.
Well, it's important to understand that the way the World Health Organization looks at the question of whether something causes cancer is to look at the full array of evidence. And that means they start out looking at experimental studies of cell cultures under controlled conditions in laboratories. They look at studies in whole animals exposed over their lifetime to various hazards. And they also then look at human epidemiologic evidence, studies in people over time and space where we've had sufficient time to observe problems. And when they looked at the totality of all of that evidence, experimental as well as human studies, they concluded that cell phone radiation, like pesticides and engine exhaust, should be regarded as a possible cause of cancer. And the group of scientists that was brought together to issue this report includes some of the most eminent experts in the world in the fields of epidemiology and toxicology, people like Professor Jonathan Sammet, who was the chairman of the Department of Epidemiology at Johns Hopkins and is now at the University of Southern California directing their global health program. People like Darius Leshinsky, who is a senior director of the Finnish Nuclear Regulatory Authority. So they put all of these people together, some 30 of them in total, and had them review the entire world literature and reach a conclusion about the strength of the evidence. So they didn't do any new research, but they did spend a great deal of time and poring in great detail over the results of all of these different studies, and they concluded that cell phone radiation should be regarded as if it is a cause of cancer in humans, because there is some human evidence. There's not as much as we will get in the future, but we do not want to wait for more evidence. The reason the World Health Organization does this is not to prove what caused cancer, but to prevent cancer from developing. In other words, they put together the evidence on the probability that cancer is going to be associated with different exposures based on experimental work and human work, and they then issue a statement because their intention is to prevent harm, not to document that harm has already happened.
Dr. Davis, what was the mobile phone industry's response to the World Health Organization? Obviously, they would see it in their economic interest, just like the tobacco companies and the asbestos manufacturers who tried to suppress and marginalize health studies that indicate their products were dangerous to people's health. What has been the line of the cell phone industry?
Well, the cell phone industry has taken the position that there's not evidence to indicate any harm, and they refer to studies and commissions that have been put together, often with extensive support from the cell phone industry, that have concluded that we don't know for sure or that there's no risk yet. And, for example, just a week ago, the International Commission on Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection, ICNIRP, issued a report saying that, contrary to the World Health Organization determination, cell phone radiation really doesn't cause brain cancer. In the conflict of interest statement for that report that was published in Environmental Health Perspectives, the authors say that this work was supported in part by grants from the cell phone manufacturers of Switzerland, France, and Germany. But they assure the, but there's no conflict of interest because they weren't really influenced by the fact that that's where the money came from. And they also acknowledge that the senior author of this paper is a stockholder in several telecom companies, but that also is, they say, no, has no impact on the kind of work that they do. Now, I don't know what you think about that, but from where I come from, where you stand depends on where you sit and who's bought your chair. And if somebody is paying millions of dollars, as the cell phone industry has, to support this, these research projects, it's hard to imagine that the research is truly independent.
What can be done regarding public policy in cell phones in terms of the influence that the cell phone industry has in blocking or suppressing things that could potentially protect the public from the hazards of cell phones? And what can individuals do right now to protect themselves?
Like with the action to ban smoking in public places, a lot of the regulatory efforts are going to come from the states right now. What you can do as individuals is first get informed and understand distance is your friend. I own a cell phone. I use it. My phone right now is sitting in front of me about 8 inches away. It's on airplane mode. That means it's not using Wi-Fi. It's not using the antenna to get information. Use a speakerphone. Use a headset, including Bluetooth. Do not keep a phone in your pocket on your body. Certainly don't keep it in your bra. Do not use a phone when the signal is weak, because that means that the tower is far away and the phone, its job is to reach that tower. So it puts out more energy to reach the tower and therefore puts more radiation out. And half of all the radiation from a phone gets directly into your head or body when you're using it. So those are some of the simple things you can do. Just remember, distance is your friend, and you will survive if you turn it off from time to time.
That was Dr. Deborah Davis, founder and president of the group Environmental Health Trust. Dr. Davis is the author of Disconnect, the Truth About Cell Phone Radiation, What the Industry Has Done to Hide It, and How to Protect Your Family. Find links to more information on the issue of cell phones and cancer by visiting our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Tony Ernst, Hank Hoffman, Hazel Kahn, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.